Good afternoon, everyone. It's good to be here. Nice to see everyone. Welcome to everyone on the webcast as well. Thank you for that special music. That was beautiful. The words were great. That just added so much. So thank you very much for that. Anytime we can have special music is such a privilege. I'd like to also say well done to Rylan Baker, Isaac Rushton, and Kyle Metzger for what you did today or doing today with song leading. Song leading is not easy. To some people it is, to me it's not. So song leading is something that I always find trying, and you make it look very good. You recovered well, which is the compliment that I got once. My mother, she never said, and she's probably watching, so she never said, "You're a good song leader." Nope. Her compliment to me was at the feast, and there were some things that happened at the feast, and I got back, and she says, "You recover well." So that was the compliment to me. So you did a really good job, and you recovered well, so you did really good there. So prayer is always one of those things I felt was one of the hardest things to do, because prayer is so intimate, but to be able to get up here and give a good prayer, which is very good, and then obviously speaking at 17 years old, there's no possible way that you could have got me up here at 17 years old to speak. There's no possible way. So well done to the three of you. That is great. Also, thank you for considering me younger. I do appreciate that. It's only in some circles that I'm considered younger. So to the ministry, I'm considered younger. To everyone else, they say, no, you're not younger. So I am not younger, so much so that recently I put together a ministerial retreat for the newer ministers. And so some of us were younger, some of us are not. So for the newer ministers, and we put this together, there's a few of us, and my daughter was talking to a friend and said, yes, my dad put together a retreat for the younger ministers. And there was a pause, and then she said, your dad is considered one of the younger ministers? So only in some circles am I one of the younger ones. So thank you for that. I'm on Youth Day, so I'm speaking on Youth Day, which is nice. All right, Jen and I'll go ahead and get into the sermon before I just keep rambling on. Jen and I don't follow very many sports. It's just not a big thing to us. I know in this room there are a lot of people that follow a lot of sports, and you follow it closely, and you love sports, but we don't follow it at all throughout the year. I have to say, embarrassingly, when the Super Bowl comes around, there's been different times on the way to a Super Bowl party, and I'm not joking, I leaned over to Jen and say, hey, who's in the Super Bowl? And she's, so I want to be with people, not so much into football itself. But sports really are not the thing that interests us all that much. After I stopped playing sports at any competitive level, I loved playing sports. Sports were my life when I was younger. I loved it. But once I stopped playing at any competitive level, my interest completely just declined. If I wasn't playing it, I lost interest in it. Although I feel there are great triumphant sports stories. I love sports stories still to this day. At times, we'll watch some of the clips of highlights, but for the most part, I have no idea what's going on in the sports world. People say people's names, and I have no idea who they are talking about. But I used to, at one point in my life, I followed boxing, baseball, basketball, and to a smaller degree other sports, but that was my world. I loved those sports. That's what I watched. But if I still followed sports, I imagine I would not have been taken by surprise what Jen and I saw, or rather heard, while watching the 2018 Winter Olympics. Now, the Olympics are a little bit different. It happens every 2 years because of Winter and Summer Olympics that we watch in our house. We watch a lot of sports during that time. The Olympics is something different. We will turn it on quite a bit to be able to see sports we never would have watched otherwise, but be able to watch those. I think we watch a lot of the Olympics because it's on a world stage and because it has such a long history to it, something that we really enjoy. They are the Titans or the gladiators of today, and there's a lot of excitement surrounding the Olympics. I enjoy that. I enjoy that a lot. Now, the Winter Olympics are newer, obviously, in history, but still outstanding athletes, and that's what we were watching. On one of the nights, we were watching the halfpipe snowboarding competition. That's one that we do enjoy watching. I know nothing about snowboarding. I did it once, and I'll never do it again. But it is interesting to see what they are able to do. But we were watching for one person in particular. I won't mention names or anything like that, but somebody that we've come to really enjoy watching when he is up there, because we were looking forward to seeing what he was able to do. Now, I don't remember everything surrounding the situation, but I believe, and I'm almost positive, it was his final run for what he was going to do, his final run. And it looked like he was going to get the bronze medal, and it looked like he was going to get it by a lot. That's where he was. There was no possible way that he was going to get anything else. He would have to put something spectacular together to be able to even get the bronze, let alone a silver and gold, and that didn't even look like it was possible. It's one of those situations that great stories come from. Great sports stories come from people that are the underdog, or it doesn't seem like it's possible, and those are the ones that we like. Those are the ones that we enjoy. Now, we were watching and excited to see what happens, and sure enough, he pulled off a run that was nothing short of spectacular. We don't know what we're doing in snowboarding, but you could tell what he just did was pretty amazing. It was awesome to be able to see. Pretty amazing to watch. At the right moment, doing the right things and landing every trick, and it looked like it was just so solid, effortless, and people, you could see it on their faces that something just great happened. After a few moments, the judges came back with his end score, and he ends up getting the gold. Didn't even look like it was possible. Pretty amazing feat. He did something that great athletes do. Under extreme stress, he pulls off an unbelievable run. It wasn't even possible, and he made it possible. Pretty great to see. You can make a great sermon about that, but we're not going to. It's what he did next that found his story in the sermon today. It was what he did afterward that made it into the sermon. When the judges announced his win, the crowd began to cheer, and it did. It erupted. It erupted like I've never seen a snowboard competition erupt, but people were going crazy for what they just saw. Eventually, he went over to his family, and they were giving hugs, and it was emotional, and he was crying, and it was great to be able to see that. And then his father came out, and they began to hug, and there was so much excitement, and there was so much joy, and then there was a lot of profanity. On live television, it just came out. And it was so you could hear every single word that came out of his mouth. Clear enough on live television to hear everything. It took a great moment and completely cheapened it. You could hear everything. There wasn't anything hidden. It was loud. Actually, there were articles written about it. It made the news. But over time, it won't on paper or record books, but it did in the ears of those who heard it. It completely just cheapened it, cheapened that moment. What was in his heart came out. It was very disappointing, to say the least. It was somebody we're looking forward to, and then all of this happened, and it just kind of just brought the whole room down. I'd like to read something to you. I found this interesting. It's an article. Take about 10 minutes to read all the statistics. No, just kidding. Just a few paragraphs off of this. The title was, "The Majority of Americans Utter Curse Words When Stressed Out, Study Finds." That was the title. That's the whole title. This is by Fox News. I'll just read a couple paragraphs. Said the average American utters their first curse word of the day at 10:54 a.m., according to new data. How they did that, I have no idea. They took a survey, 10:54. 10:53, nobody says anything, but 10:54, that's when it all happens. So 10:54 a.m. Said a study into the everyday stress and frustration of 2,000 Americans, so obviously they took a survey, aimed to explore how much stress Americans take on and how exactly they deal with it. Having a bad day, you might be one in four Americans who can't get past 9 a.m. without cursing most days, while the majority of respondents swear before 11 a.m. Those 2,000 people are quite honest about when they swear. One last paragraph says, as mentioned above, cursing is the most popular way people express their frustration. Well, if that's the case, as time goes on, it's only going to get worse. Said, with 63% saying that's how it's manifested for them most frequently. Yelling is another popular method of relief, and I would guess that both of those sometimes are mixed, with 49% and, sadly enough, crying 39%. But 63% of people, when they get frustrated, that's how it comes out. Or, as we saw within the snowboarding competition, when victory happens, that's also when it can come out. Let's go ahead and go to Colossians 3. There's one verse in particular, but I think there is a great value in seeing the surrounding verses as we work our way up to it. Colossians 3. Colossians 3, starting in verse 1. Is there a way to turn on this light? It is a light, right? It's not a touch light. There's a button. Okay. So Colossians 3, verse 1. Also, listen to how many times, as we're reading through this, listen to all the you and your when he's talking. It makes it very personal. You and your. So Colossians 3, verse 1 says, "If then you were raised with Christ, seek those things which are above, where Christ is, sitting at the right hand of God." He starts off with this great instruction here. He's talking about a way of living, how you live your life, what you're going to seek, and how you desire to live. It becomes a desire, something that you want, something that you desire so much. That's what your mind is going to be. He is emphasizing that they are separate from the world. There's an idea here that they are in the world, but they're not of the world. You are something different, he is saying. Verse 2, "Set your mind on things above, not on things on the earth." A rejection of Satan's world and a rejection of his influence, because he has a lot of influence. We live in this world and we know that. So we immediately see that this is referring to a massive subject. And that's why we're talking about this. It's a big subject he's talking about. He's talking about something very important that refers to all of them, or refers to all of us. We see the word seeking in verse 1, which refers to the desire for. You're seeking it, or striving for the things above. Then you see the word set in verse 2, which refers to these things taking up a lot of time in our minds. We think about them. We contemplate them. We want them to soak in. It becomes this desire. Verse 3, "For you died, and your life is hidden with Christ in God." He's speaking to converted people here, but he's speaking to all people within the congregations of God. Those who are baptized have made the commitment and entered into that covenant relationship with God. Many of you will make that as well and seek that. He's reminding them of what they did and the category it places them in. Let's go to Deuteronomy 23. Hold your finger here. We'll come back to Colossians. Deuteronomy 23. Deuteronomy 23, verse 21. Deuteronomy 23 and verse 21. Again, we will be back in Colossians in just a minute. Deuteronomy 23, verse 21 says, "When you make a vow to the Lord your God, you shall not delay to pay it, for the Lord your God will surely require it of you, and it will be sin to you. But if you abstain from vowing, it shall be a sin. It shall not be a sin to you. That which has gone from your lips, you shall keep and perform, for your voluntary vow to the Lord your God, what you have promised with your mouth." This is a section certain or miscellaneous laws, but this shows how important it is when you go into a vow or covenant with God. And many of you will. Many of us have already gone into that. You entered into it, and you better do all you can to uphold your end. He's saying otherwise it's sin. God expects us to follow through with our commitment to God. Let's go ahead and go back to Colossians 3. That's what he's talking about here. Colossians 3, verse 3. Let's read verse 3 again. It says, "For you died, and your life is hidden with Christ in God. When Christ, who is our life, appears, when you also will appear with him in glory." So first he reminds them of their agreement, your future agreement, what they may have entered into. But then he reminds them of the reward, that incredible reward that we look forward to. We were just talking about it before services began. We had a conversation of that reward, actually a couple times. That's what we talk about. That's what we want, that reward, being able to be with Christ. These first four verses were setting the stage for what he's about to say. He built that picture in their minds. He was showing them what was at stake. That's why he talks about it, the first four verses. Then he goes on to teach. Verse 5. So all of that was just the stage. We kind of get to see how big that stage is. It says, "Therefore, put to death your members which are on the earth, fornication, uncleanness, passion, evil desire, covetousness, which is idolatry." He was telling the Colossians, if these things live in you, put them to death. Why? Because you don't want to be like the world. You don't want to be like the surrounding world. Bury that man. That man was supposed to be dead. These were the qualities of the earth that he spoke about in verse 2. Qualities of the earth. He said, set your mind on things above. Set your mind on things of God. Verse 6 says, "Because of these things, the wrath of God is coming upon the sons of disobedience, in which you yourselves once walked when you lived in them. But now you yourselves are to put off all things, anger, wrath, malice, blasphemy, filthy language out of your mouth. Verse 9, do not lie to one another, since you have put off the old man with his deeds, and you have put on the new man who is renewed in knowledge according to the image of him who created him. Let's finish this out. Verse 11, where there is neither Greek nor Jew, circumcised nor uncircumcised, barbarian, Scythian, slave nor free, but Christ is all and in all. No separation of any person from Jesus Christ. But he's saying you have more work to do. You may have overcome the first list, but there's more. We must desire the new man who is created in the image of him who created us. We see that as Jesus Christ. All of this was very extremely important. We concentrated on this to show that subject matter was putting on Christ. You're being clothed in Christ, how he walked, how he thought, how he acted, all of those things. I want to draw our attention back to verse 8. Verse 8. And sometimes I think we might minimize this, and it shouldn't be. Verse 8 said that we are to put off the filthy language of our mouth. We look at that and we say, do we see the stage that this was put on? The subject matter that this was placed with and how important it was. That's why we concentrated on it. It's a huge picture, and all of a sudden he brings it back to even filthy language of what that is. It's much bigger than you need to watch your mouth, or a gentleman or a lady doesn't speak like that. No, he lays it at the feet of the old man, obviously the way of life that you guys are seeking to live, a product of a son of disobedience, or as King James Version says, the children of disobedience. All people can walk this way. He's saying this is not a product of someone who's desiring to be more like Jesus Christ. It's not a product of that. It's not a product of your creator. I would also add that filthy language should be a jolt to our system when we do hear. It should be something. I worked in a steel mill for 6 years. I learned all kinds of things. I learned new language I didn't even know. And you work in a steel mill for a while, and you get to learn all kinds of things that we should never, ever talk about, let alone think about. Stuff that we don't want. We get surrounded by it. It doesn't matter. Schools, and it doesn't matter if you're homeschooled. You're surrounded by it. Not by the teachers, but you're surrounded, but you can't hide from it. It's all around. It is something that we need to be mindful of. But filthy language isn't the sole topic of this message. I don't think there's anybody here that just lets it fly. I don't think there's anybody. That's not really the meaning of this message. But rather the value of our words. How powerful our words are and what we use. But talking about the stage that we just looked at and just that value of those words, very big. The power of our speech, how God's people are identified by our words, and what we do with them matter. Our words really do matter. Let's go to Genesis 11. Let's go back to Genesis 11. Here we have a well-known story, which isn't over yet. It continues forward, but I want to concentrate on part of it. Genesis 11. Genesis 11. I'm going to start in verse 1. Obviously, if you have a title in your Bible, it says the Tower of Babel. It shows you the power of words. Genesis 11, verse 1. It says, now the whole earth had one language and one speech. Everyone had one language. They spoke the same way. F.B. Meyer said, the one language or lip refers to the pronunciation, speech to the stock of words. The language was the same, but so was the cause. That becomes a big problem, an issue, the underlying issue here. The word speech here is different than what we're going to see in verse 7. It's a very different word than what we're going to see. The Hebrew word, dabar, means a matter of a thing or a cause. Their one language led to a unified cause. Verse 2 said, and if it came to pass, as they journeyed from the east, that they found a plain in the land of Shinar, and they dwelt there. Then they said to one another, come, let us make bricks and bake them thoroughly. They had bricks for stone, and they had asphalt for mortar. Verse 4, and they said, come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower whose top is in the heavens. Let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be scattered abroad over the face of the whole earth. You can make messages just out of that one verse right there. But a couple things to notice here is, one, is that the phrase, whose top is in the heavens, that was just an expression of something very high. It was just something very tall. It was taller than everything else. That area, anyway, is so very flat. It was taller than everything else. It was in the heavens. Although I don't take the stance that they were trying to protect themselves from another flood or trying to reach God's throne, the attitude of great disobedience was there. That was what they had, an attitude of great disobedience. In essence, if you're not going to listen to God, you're trying to replace him. The second thing that we can notice here is that disobedience was against a command from God. It was against that command. Their language and unified speech, their cause, was unified against what God actually told them to do. I think it's pretty accurate. He says, they did it to prevent their dispersion, lest we be scattered abroad upon the face of the earth. It was done in disobedience to that command. They didn't want to listen to God. Replenish the earth. God orders them to disperse. And they said no. Their speech, their cause, was powerful. Powerful, but destructive in this case. Let's go to verse 5. It said, but the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the sons of men had built. And the Lord said, indeed, the people are one, and they all have one language, and this is what they begin to do. Now nothing that they propose to do will be withheld from them. Man took too much power upon themselves. This wasn't God saying, I won't be able to do anything to stop them. If they get too much, I can't do anything. It wasn't God saying that. He wasn't saying, I'll be powerless. But rather, man will have too much control of what they're doing. Evil and wickedness of man would again be like it says in Genesis 6 and verse 5. And I'll just read it. It says, then the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intent of their thoughts of their hearts was only evil continually. We're gradually getting back to that at this point in Genesis, moving back on the same path. The decisions of man, the influence of Satan, was already heavily at work again. The consequences of man's choices were already being set in motion. It was done by the power of speech, by the heart. Words are powerful. Something else to notice is, having unity isn't enough for us. We talk about unity a lot, but can unity be a bad thing? They were unified, but for a wrong cause. Separately, man can do very little, but unified, man can do much, even if for the purpose of an evil cause. Verse 7, come, let us go down and there confuse their language, that they may not understand one another's speech. This word speech is different than what we saw in verse 1. It simply means language. It is meaning God is taking away the tool used to identify them or unify them. He is talking about taking away the tool used to build their cause. He's taking that away, that powerful thing, their words. And he said, all right, we're going to mess that up so that they don't continue on the path that they are on. Verse 8, so the Lord scattered them abroad from there over the face of all the earth, and they ceased building the city. God's command was enforced. So man becomes very foolish to believe that they can reject or push off the commands of God. Sadly, it doesn't stop man from trying over and over and over again. All of us. Verse 9 said, therefore its name is called Babel, because there the Lord confused the language of all the earth, and from there the Lord scattered them abroad over the face of all the earth. What he commanded was going to happen no matter what. Babylon is born, a botched empire that seems to never die. It'll die in the future, but it's not dead yet. One of these days it'll be put down for good. However, the story is only one story of many stories throughout history that the power of words and speech, it shows the power of words and speech and how it's used for power and influence. Let's look at a smaller scale of something, but just as destructive. Let's go to Proverbs 7. Proverbs 7, I'm going to do something here that I don't usually do and read the chapter. Proverbs 7, there's sections to it. Proverbs 7 and verse 1. Proverbs 7, I'm starting in verse 1, says, my son, this is Solomon speaking, my son, keep my words and treasure my commands within you. Keep my commands and live. He says, in my law as the apple of your eye. And that's talking about the pupil. It's what it's concentrating on, that law. Verse 3, bind them on your fingers, what you do. Write them on the tablet of your heart, how you feel. Everything that makes you you, that it becomes who you are. Say to wisdom, you are my sister, and call understanding your nearest kin. that they may keep you from the immoral woman, from the seductress who flatters with her words. Here we have an introduction in the form of the Father's warning. It is a warning of a seductress, an immoral woman. The main concentration is that wisdom and understanding are the tools a person has to reject and fight against lust. Now, that's not to make people uncomfortable like Mr. Smith's marriage sermons. This is talking about the lust of sin, the attractiveness of sin. And what we're going to see is kind of this imagery of that being played out. The power of a seductress and her words. Then in verse 6 starts a narrative of the dangers of this seductress. What she's able to use. Again, that's sin talking. The story goes well beyond an immoral woman. This woman here pictures more than just a woman. It's not what it's talking about. She is a representative of evil, of sin, and the enticement of sin. That sometimes sin can be very enticing. Sin can be very attractive. Verse 6. For the window of my house, I looked through my lattice, and I saw among the simple, I perceived among the youths, a young man devoid of understanding. This can be a young man, can be people in general, passing along the street near her corner. And he took the path to her house in the twilight, in the evening, in the black, in the dark night. Here the story is developing of a young man devoid of wisdom and understanding. He was of the simple. Again, as we move forward, this is referring to luring and attractiveness of sin, not referring to this sin in particular or only one type of sin. Verse 10 says, "And there a woman met him with the attire of a harlot and crafty heart. She was loud and rebellious. Her feet would not stay at home. At times she was outside, at times she was in the open square, lurking at every corner." This is describing sin as opportunistic. Sin will do what it can to get your attention. Live within you, however possible. Sin doesn't try to hide itself, but when someone is ill-equipped to fight against sin, sin then can be heard and seen, easily found. You can find it very easily. This fits so much with our world now because you can find sin so easily on our computers, our phones, whatever it is, so very easy. You can find it. It's there. She is loud, seeking, lurking, crafty. Sin is sometimes outside or in the open square and lurking at every corner. What is sin doing? Well, two things. Two things sin is doing. One, looking for the simple, and two, making herself easy to find. That's what sin is doing. Verse 13 says, So she caught him and kissed him. With an impudent face, he said to him, "I have peace offering with me. Today I have paid my vows." Continue forward. "So I came out to meet you diligently to seek your face, and I found you. I've spread my bed with tapestry, colored coverings of Egyptian linen. I've perfumed my bed with myrrh and aloes and cinnamon. Come, let us take our fill of love until morning. Let us delight ourselves with love. For my husband is not at home. He has gone on a long journey. He has taken a bag of money with him and will come home on an appointed day." Obviously, it's very descriptive. Very descriptive of what's talking about. She is appealing to the simple, the ill-equipped, those without wisdom and understanding or conviction to God's laws. It's appealing to them. Do we see how pleasant she made everything seem? How enticing it was? Do you also see how sin created the illusion that it was okay? And in fact, there's no problem. There's no issue. There's no danger. We're not going to get caught. That's what sin does. You're not going to get caught. Verse 21. With her enticing speech, she caused him to yield. With her flattering lips, she seduced him. Here's the negative power of speech. Words can be used to seduce someone, to change someone's course. Powerful words. This is applied to all sin, all false doctrine, all teachings. Something sounds good, but it isn't. It's the power of speech, the power of our words. Verse 22. Said, immediately he went after her as an ox goes to the slaughter or a fool to the correction of the stocks. Till an arrow struck his liver, as a bird hastens to the snare, he did not know it would cost his life. Seductive words that appeal to the heart are destructive. Let's read on. Let's finish this out. Verse 24. Now therefore, listen to me, my children. Pay attention to the words of my mouth. There are good words. There are wrong words. Do not let your heart turn aside to her ways. Do not stray into her paths, for she has cast down many wounded, and all who were slain by her were strong men. Her house is the way to hell, descending to the chambers of death. He is pleading to listen to his words, the words of wisdom, the words of understanding. He tells of a strong man, and that's not strong in righteousness, but is saying that sin has made many strong men fall. This is a great illustration of mankind throughout history. I wanted to give these two stories because it illustrates speech as a force. It talks about how powerful speech is, how it moves somebody, how destructive it can be. Something we can't take lightly. In these two stories, it was a very negative force at work. I will say that life around us has a lot of negative forces out there. The force at work in these cases were to get what they wanted without regard for others, and most importantly, without regard to God. Either dividing man from man or man from God. That's probably the most powerful thing that sin does, is dividing man from God. Very powerful. God says we do not do that. The words we use are a tool, and a very important tool at that. And he gives us that gift of speech and those words to be able to use them correctly. They should be guarded, preserved, and used wisely. Get this, God gave us the gift with the ability to use our words. The question is, how do we use them? How do we use them outside of this room? How do we use them at home? How do we use them at school? How do we use them at work, wherever we might be? Let's go to Jude. Jude 16. Here God is going to give an example of what we're not to be. These are warnings. Jude is just one chapter. Jude, verse 16. Jude, verse 16. There were people that were sneaking into the church at this point, not good people. And he says, these are grumblers, Jude 16. These are grumblers, complainers, walking according to their own lusts. And they mouth great, swelling words, flattering people to gain advantage. They were using their words, and it was moving people in a wrong way. This goes with the two stories we just read. Their speech was used for what they wanted. Verse 17, but you, beloved, remember the words which were spoken by the apostles of the Lord Jesus Christ, how they told you that there would be mockers in the last times who would walk according to their own ungodly lusts. These are sensual persons who cause divisions, not having the Spirit. Their speech would cause division. Divisive words are powerful words. Something we have to watch out for. But something very important to note is that their speech was not guided by God's Spirit. You do have God working with you. Many of us in this room have God within us. Our speech is to be different. How we talk, how we act, all of those should be different. We are to be identified by the words that come out of our mouth. That is something that most certainly happens. We are identified with how we talk, the words that come out of our mouth. We are to be identified by our motives and our speech. There are 3 points of this message, 3 points of what our speech, as we strive to live how God wants us to, is to accomplish, what our speech is to do, how we are to be with one another, how we are to be with one another in this room, our local congregations, at camps, it doesn't matter, at all times, 100% of the time. Number one, our words, and I would say this is a huge one, to your peers, being able to have this. Number one, our words should edify. Our words should edify. Edification means the act of building or building up. Our words should be something that builds and strengthens the people around you. Thayer's put it this way in reference to the quality of someone. It says, the act of one who promotes another's growth in Christian wisdom, piety, happiness, and holiness. How many of us would love to have those words put on us? Say, I definitely want that. The question is, does our speech, how we talk to others, how we talk to each other, build up or does it tear down? How we're walking around. Do we look at it from that point of view, or is it just, you know, it just comes out sometimes, that just I say it how it is, whatever it might be. Let's go to Ephesians 4. Ephesians 4. I will say with this group here, what I see is this one being acted out. I hear it a lot, and I love it. The words that we see here among the younger is wonderful. Ephesians 4, verse 29. Ephesians 4, verse 29, we'll just read that one verse, says, "Let no corrupt word proceed out of your mouth, but what is good for necessary edification, that it may impart grace to the hearers." That's a wonderful verse. God expects us to build one another up. Doesn't matter our age, that's what he's expecting us to do. Not in a false way, not with swelling words, like we read in Jude. He's talking about truth, seeing the good in people, not concentrating on the things that tear down. Being able to use these words is a powerful thing to help somebody. Even correction done in the right way edifies instead of demolishing somebody. The reason for correction is not to hurt, but to help. Let's go to Romans 15. Romans 15. Romans 15. Starting in verse 1. Romans 15. Starting in verse 1. Says, "We then, who are strong, ought to bear with the scruples of the weak and not to please ourselves." Again, the focus is to be off of ourselves. When this is done, even our speech changes. Verse 2, "Let each of us please his neighbor for his good, leading to edification." Verse 3, "For even Christ did not please himself, but as it is written, the reproaches of those who reproached you fell on me." Our words, how we deal with each other, is for the progression of for each of us as a progression of as a Christian, to help each other in our walk, to build, and in some cases, to rebuild. Sometimes we need to do the rebuilding. Number two, avoid offense. And I have a hyphen, peaceable and gentle. Avoid offense, peaceable and gentle. We as a people, you as teens, can be easily offended at times. I can be easily offended at times, too easily offended. But at times we may even easily offend others. I know I've offended people. It's not something we ever want to do or strive to do. Let's go to Romans 12, but it does happen. Romans 12, verse 18. Romans 12, verse 18 says, If it is possible, it doesn't say, hey, 100% of all times, this has to happen. No, sometimes possible is not an option. But a lot of times, most times it is. If it is possible, as much as depends on you, live peaceably with all men. Obviously, there may be situations out of our control. But the teaching here is anything that is within that control, which is a lot, must be done in peace. That means the words coming out of our mouths must be words spoken to achieve or promote peace. Talked about before in other messages, we have to be factories of peace. These are actually things that we must pursue. Let's go to Romans 14. I like this one because it binds the first point and this point together. Romans 14, verse 19. Romans 14, verse 19. Says, "Therefore, let us pursue the things which make for peace and the things by which one may edify another." By fellowship, by words, we become peaceful builders of one another. I think it's a tool, a powerful tool that we can use. Not in our own desires, such as the story of Tower of Babel, but the world saw defiance and self-seeking at the Tower of Babel. What do we see in each other? What does the world see when we pursue peace with one another? What is that? Let's go to Hebrews 12. Hebrews 12. Hebrews 12. Again, read one verse. Hebrews 12, verse 14. Very similar. "Pursue peace with all people in holiness, without which no one will see the Lord." It won't happen if we are not doing that. How we deal with one another, how we speak to one another, helps us see God in one another. I think that's a powerful thing. Here's an example. If someone in the world gets in your face and begins shouting, for whatever the reason is, you start thinking, maybe it's in traffic, maybe it's in whatever it might be. Somebody gets in your face, starts shouting with anger, and you get right back in their face, and you begin shouting too. How dare them do that? So you get back in their face, and you begin shouting. Maybe there's an issue that happens. The question becomes, after that moment, maybe you won the whole shouting battle, whatever that might be. The question becomes, what did they teach you about the world? Nothing. They didn't teach you about the world at all. The world is angry. Question is, what did you teach them about the church? Nothing. It looks like the world and the church are the same in that example. What we could have done could have been better. Our speech or our cause is different than the cause and the speech of the world. Let's turn to Colossians 4. Go to Colossians 4. Colossians 4. Read one verse here. Colossians 4. In verse 6. Colossians 4, verse 6 says, "Let your speech always be with grace, seasoned with salt, that you may know how you ought to answer each other." He's saying, know what you're going to say. Know how you're going to say it. Respond well. Treat each other nice. Using grace. It's a great verse. Not only are we not going to offend, but we are to provide grace. I think Barnes explains it well. He says this. He says, salt among the Greeks was the emblem of wit. Here the meaning seems to be that our conversation should be seasoned with piety or grace in a way similar to that which we employ salt in our foods. It goes on to say that it becomes, if you add too much salt, it takes over everything. You don't want to do that. You want it to be seasoned with salt. You want your words to be correct. You don't want your word to be salt. You want it to be seasoned with salt. Our words need to be seasoned with grace. In other words, grace is not to be our speech, as that would be too syrupy, but rather the seasoning of our speech, a great way to avoid offense, but also to build up, to edify. Number three, our words need to be that of love. Our words need to be that of love. All of these go together. Thought this was a valuable point to add because love fuels the other two points. If either point is done without brotherly love, it becomes empty, it becomes put on. We can't have that. Love is how you fulfill edification. It's how you have peace and gentleness. Love is what makes our speech genuine when that is there. Breaking into a thought in this, go to Ephesians 4. Ephesians 4. This is one of Paul's long scriptures, long thought process is Ephesians 4, but we can pick it up in verse 14. Ephesians 4, verse 14. I think we can get the point without starting at the beginning. Ephesians 4, verse 14 says that we should no longer be children tossed to and fro and carried about with every wind of doctrine by the trickery of men and the cunning craftiness of deceitful plotting. But speaking the truth in love, may grow up in all things into him who is the head, Christ. Literally meaning what he's talking about is truthing in love is the literal meaning of that. Truthing in love. What comes out of us is truthing in love. Jameson Fawcett Brown says, truth in word and act, love in manner and spirit are the Christian rule. Becomes how we're programmed. We reprogram ourselves. Meaning what comes out of us is done in truth. Not with a fakeness, but with a genuine heart. Why? Verse 16. From whom the whole body, that's all everyone in this room, in God's church, joined and knit together by what every joint supplies according to the effect of working by which every part does its share, causes growth of the body for the edifying, there it is again, of itself in love. What is love inwardly will be spoken to others. This builds and edifies and therefore produces love. But the Apostle John gives us a warning about what our love should be. Let's go to 1 John 3. 1 John 3. 1 John 3, verse 17. Title of mine above verse 16 says, the outworking of love. 1 John 3, verse 17 says, but whoever has this world's goods and sees his brother in need and shuts up his heart from him, how does the love of God abide in him? Verse 18, my little children, let us not saying, don't use your words. He's not saying only do actions. He's saying, don't let your words be empty. Our actions must support the words that we use. Our words must be truthful and outflowing from a transformed heart being led by God's Spirit, which is, again, the desire. God is working with you, absolutely. I'd like to turn to one last scripture in conclusion. Let's go to James 1. James 1. This makes it into many messages. This few verses here that I'm going to read has become many messages. James 1, verse 19. Just going to read two verses. James 1, verse 19 says, so then, my beloved brethren, let every man be swift to hear, slow to speak, slow to wrath. Whole lot easier said than done. That's a powerful verse. So let every man be swift to hear, slow to speak, slow to wrath. For the wrath of man does not produce the righteousness of God. I believe this is how we are to conduct ourselves at all times. At all times, especially with each other, with one another, but also with the world too. I think sometimes the best way to speak is not to speak quickly. It's not always not to speak at all, but not to speak quickly. I also think the most valuable part of conversion and what you're working towards is done with the ears, or a conversation is done with the ears, not with the mouth. Obviously, you need both, but the ears help the mouth know what to say, when to say it, and how to say it. I think it's a wonderful scripture. If you speak too quickly, the ears never have a chance to hear what is being said. Our words matter. As teens, as adults, let us be a people who God is seen through us by being swift to hear, slow to speak, those who edify, those who avoid offense by being peaceful and gentle, and those who do all with love.